listen to this kind of music every day. That's Doodlin' by Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers, the legendary pianist, arranger, and composer at the helm. That was recorded in 1954 and features some other great jazz legends: Hank Mobley on tenor sax, Kenny Dorham on trumpet, Doug Watkins on bass, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, the last day of June. And welcome to Lead Stories once again. Our guest is tied up at the U.S. Supreme Court, and so I don't think he's going to be joining us because the court has decided to revisit a case. And this case concerns affirmative action, a case that the court had heard before. We had discussed this, as a matter of fact, at great length right here on this program. The case involves a white young woman applying for admission to the University of Texas at Austin, and she claims that she was denied admission to the entering class of 2008 on the basis of her race, and others, of course, being admitted, being given, quote, preferential treatment by virtue of their race. We had discussed this in detail here, and we'll just continue monitoring the outcome of this case. This was probably the last decision that the court will make in its current term, having made a number of historic decisions, not all of them well-received, and many of them raising questions, as we'll find out and discuss on all sides of the spectrum, the political spectrum. In some cases, it pleased a lot of people. In other cases, it outraged a lot of people. But in every case, it raised questions about whether the court has become over-politicized. So our guest is going to join us perhaps another day, perhaps as early as tomorrow, because of the decision, the late decision by the courts to rehear this case. It was a surprise, as a matter of fact. It was not on the schedule, but the court decided to hear it. Now, how they will rule is a whole other story, but it is a case that is being watched very, very closely because it has great implications for what we have come to know as affirmative action, especially within educational institutions, as a way of giving members of a minority, as they use the word, I can't stand the word, but non-white people attending or wanting to attend universities that have programs that are aimed at giving some kind of redress to the purposeful and intentional exclusion of these groups from the universities, from universities across the country. Specifically, it was aimed at increasing what is called racial and ethnic diversity. And so this is a very, very important case. So we will hear from him, hopefully, during the course of the program. But if not, we certainly will return for the whole hour to discuss the U.S. Supreme Court decisions that came down in this term. Many of them will have far-reaching consequences, and you need to get an idea of the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings. You know, depending on where you are historically, I hear a call coming in, but that might be him. So we will take this short break. Let's see if we can organize and find out whether he's in a position to continue or whether he's covering the Supreme Court at this time. We'll be back right after this. Well, we got the news. He is, in fact, monitoring the case. It's Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, and the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing it. So we will continue with our program from yesterday, talking about the president's speech, eulogy, in Charleston, South Carolina, and the significance of that speech, because everybody agrees it was historic. But it was historic for many reasons. And my position is that it was historic relating to the theme that we have been talking about, and that is that we have to confront the reality of our existence, and the reality of our existence is that we are living in a country with a deep-seated, deeply embedded philosophy and practice of white supremacy. It is an apartheid country. And all the hints that have been given have been ignored. And the president's appearance at this very awful occasion, the awful occasion being the massacre, meaning several people, nine people in all, killed on June 17th by a white supremacist in Charleston, South Carolina. And among them is or was the pastor of the church where a Bible study and prayer meeting were going on at the time that this gunman just unleashed, sprayed the place with bullets, killing nine people, including the pastor who was an elected official. And I remarked that the speech was very interesting in the way that the president decided to dance around reality, create a different reality other than the one that everybody was staring at. He was, in fact, standing behind the casket containing the body of Reverend Clementa Pinckney, and the president refused, absolutely refused, to refer to his death in the correct way. It was not a passing. He wasn't just killed. This was an assassination. And in fact, we can look at it as applying to all nine of the victims assassinated. By definition, assassination is about a surprise attack on by a person or persons politically motivated, and that's what this was. But the president insisted that he would present this in a different way, and that it was about a test of faith, a test of grace. God had given us a moment of grace, he said. And in that moment, it is our job, all of a sudden, we're all in this together. It is our job to now find somehow an extra helping of grace to humanize the society, to redeem it, to give it some kind of veneer. The victims are supposed to do that. Now, the president consistently has failed, and this particular speech was so repugnant, so insulting, because even in the midst of an actual tragedy, the president still is ducking the issue. And the references to race have to do with him, not with the reality that people had just come through and still are dealing with. Nothing that involves an accounting by him of what his administration has not been able to do or been able to do, or what he envisions or what he believes the responsibility of his administration and of him is. This business of generic, all of a sudden, the people who are suffering, the people who are really hurting, the people who have been targeted, and in this case, very blatantly targeted, are the very ones he comes into the church. I'm not the church. He comes into this building, and I talked about the symbolism of that building. He comes there to deliver the message that they ought to somehow forget all of that. That's in the past. And look ahead. Because God has basically organized this moment in time so that the people who are being done in could summon up an extra helping of grace to pull them through. How insulting is that? How contemptible is that? And he goes into this mode. By the way, he could at least, and I know where he got all that intonation and the cadence from, and that goes back to the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. You may remember the preacher of Chicago engaged in actual liberation theology, the same Jeremiah Wright that Obama distanced himself from because people decided that he was way too radical. And they kept playing this speech as if he was saying something unpatriotic when he said, "God damn America," as if he just had no use for America. That's, and we know clearly that's not what it was. He was saying the message that we should have heard from Barack Obama on Friday, that this country has a deep determination not to do the right thing or follow the law, obey the law. It is absolutely determined not to do it. We are here discussing in 2015 provisions in the Voting Rights Act. In 2015, we are here talking about simplistic, basic requirements that by law, the same law that you want everybody to uphold and to observe, the same law that makes the United States this leading, quote, democracy, unquote, that you want everybody to look to as an exemplar of the good life and the way societies ought to operate and run. But your Supreme Court was the same court that said black man has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. The Supreme Court is the same court that said black people were three-fifths of a person, that upheld segregation, racial discrimination, housing discrimination. That was the lever, the cudgel wielded by this white supremacist country as the law that we all ought to obey and abide by. The law of disfranchisement, the law of inequality, the law of trenchant racism. That's the law. But this president is standing before the casket, and he knows the symbolism of it. Because he too has gotten warnings that he could be in a casket himself. He's gotten that message already several times. How many threats has he received by virtue simply of his race? Or the perceived idea that he's just way out of his league. We cannot abide black leadership in this nation. We can't have that. That does not flow with the idea of white supremacy. And how many threats has he received that we don't even know of? We know of several attempts to assassinate him, and still you're there at a funeral, you are eulogizing this man, and the best thing you think you could say to the nation at a time when you have a ready example of just exactly how sick this nation is. You tell us he's a good man. That's what we need to know about Reverend Pinckney. He was a good man. He didn't get killed because he was a good man. The other eight did not get killed because they were good people. They were killed because they were black. Period. The killer himself said so. Informed, he said, by the ideals of the Confederacy and of white supremacy. But in the moment that we are living the reality, the president chooses to reconstruct or re-scramble the moment and make it something else. All week long, he said, he had been contemplating on the matter of grace, as if it has anything to do with the fact that we have a nation that persists with this pernicious practice and that has held a particular population, and not the only one. African Americans are not the only ones, but there's a unique history here. Native Americans, more than anybody else, could tell you this story. Japanese Americans could tell you that story. They thought they were Americans, and one day they were herded up and just shipped off to internment camps. Nobody would associate that with the freedom and democracy loving the United States. But that's the reality. That's the reality. But right in the moment, this president runs a game. Same thing with Hillary Clinton. They all run the same game. And it proves what I'm talking about systems. There was every expectation, and this was exactly what was calculated, because this is a science, an applied science. They know exactly which buttons to press. And here we are, black people are so happy to have the president in their midst. He hasn't come through town for a long time. He made appropriate appearances when he was running. And largely, as you review the speech, it was about preparing this community, and using, this is what is so offensive about this president, using this horrific situation for political advantage for his Democratic Party. Hillary did it. Well, this time he said, you know what, I've got the whole floor, nobody else, I got it. And he uses that pulpit in a manner that would befit the future of the Democratic Party and his so-called political legacy. Has nothing to do. He did not leave there. Nobody left there any more convinced about what this president is prepared to do in terms of solutions to the problems that African Americans historically have been facing in this country. He's in the seat of the Confederacy. In Charleston, South Carolina, the seat of slavery, the very seat of it. And instead, he cannot tell people what his administration has done, not just about race, they call it now race relations. They have all these different ways of phrasing what we know is the unbridled truth. This is an apartheid nation ruled by white supremacy, plain and simple. That's the unvarnished truth. You can't escape it. But we have the leaders now coming to the very community and insulting their intelligence. Obama, before he even got to town, knew that he was going to razzle-dazzle them, talk that talk, study the cadence of Martin Luther King and Jeremiah Wright, and see if you could figure up something of your own, put your own little touch on that, sing a nice little song, and people would love you. You would have struck gold. Now, you're not talking anything substantive. You're not telling us anything new. You're not educating us about your direct involvement, your administration's direct involvement in solutions, but you're repeating the problems. The president even had the nerve to tell people that Clementa Pinckney was important, an important leader. Why? Because he addressed the dreadful state of education in Charleston. Well, that's your administration, isn't it? Isn't it, Mr. President? And to address unemployment, there you go, your administration again. So he's talking in these vague terms because all of these things, Clementa Pinckney was trying to rectify. Why? Because he was a good man and a man of grace. And 9 people had to die, had to be assassinated, so that we can have a conversation. The nation can have a conversation about something it has no intention of conversing about. And from the president comes the one thing that would work, which is the people who are getting kicked in the teeth should console themselves with the idea of grace. And they should work a little bit harder if they can, and they must, to transfer that spirit of grace to the wider society, including the society that's doing them in. Because after all, African Americans are just so good at suffering. Noble, he said, they died nobly. All this nonsense, this insulting nonsense. And then he breaks into song like one of the Shylites, singing the wrong song, Amazing Grace, that saved a wretch like me. Maybe he was trying to tell us something. Maybe he was singing about himself. But I do know this, you listen to this entire speech, and not one thing in it, A, recognizes the political nature of this crime. An assassination has occurred, and the president himself will not admit it, would not have his lips pronounce it. You know how awful that is? And there you do your magic to convince people that the immediate moment that they're in has no connection at all to hundreds of years of their history. That this massacre and assassination has no connection at all to the massacres and assassinations we have experienced as a community for hundreds of years. That was his chief role, to subsume that, to compel hurting people to disconnect it. Because to connect it gives you legitimate claim against the society. It legitimizes your rational response, which is to say, I don't trust this. I'm not going to be part of it. Y'all can go to hell. You've had the benefit of time. You have had the benefit of doubt. But the evidence shows conclusively there is no intent to change. And so we have to see to our interests. And we have to be ruthless and obsessive about our interests. And just move out of the way. Just disregard anybody or anything, any system that is not relevant to my condition, my needs, my interests. We have to disregard you. We have to disregard you. We have to move away from you, or move you away from us. Which means we have to dump the Democratic Party. We have to make sure it has no further relevance in our lives. We have to, if we're going to deal with it, compel it to deal with it on your terms. But what are your terms? We have no leadership. So we are, in a sense, stuck with having to start things all over again. There's nothing wrong there. That is life. Many times you have to start from scratch. All I'm saying is, start from scratch, but with clarity. Be clear about what your situation is. Be clear about who your friends are and who your enemies are, where your interests lie. To whom do you owe allegiance? Be clear about these things. And do not tolerate anyone, particularly Barack Hussein Obama. Do not fall for this, not from him. Not from him. You're going to come into town with all the pomp and circumstance, and you're going to get up there and you put on a minstrel show, the chief and only purpose of which is to calm people down so they do nothing, so that nothing really changes. The man actually says, he actually lumps together this massacre with the massacre in Connecticut, where this young man mowed down all those school children, the massacre at the movie theater in Colorado, as if they're the same. And he does this to make the point about gun control, which is one of his ideas. And gun control became a major idea for him, a major concern for him, because white children were killing white children. Immediately, he gave Joe Biden the portfolio, get this matter solved within a month. And within a month, Joe Biden produced a working plan. You remember we talked about that here. Nobody in the room, really. You didn't see any black folks who were predominantly the victims of gun violence in this country. But in the course of supposedly delivering a eulogy, he just so neatly fit in all of the platforms, all of the things that are on his political agenda, which is very insulting. It's like the Hollywood move. Let's not talk about me. Let's talk about you. So what do you think about me? You come to a funeral and you disregard the solemnity of the situation and the respect that is due not only to Clementa Pinckney, but specifically to Clementa Pinckney, because in the end, the funeral is about an assassination. Do I need to make it any clearer? This is no ordinary funeral. And he was not the only victim of an assassination. 9 people. This should cause Black America to go absolutely up against the Democratic Party. Every elected official. Don't tell me you were there and you applauded and how nice it was. CNN unleashed its Black contingent. You know, because only Black people understand Black people. And what are they talking about in this coverage? They all signed on to the idea that the meaning of the moment was that President Obama seemed to have embraced his Black self. And look, he actually sang. Isn't that great? You're talking about history repeating itself. History reminding you that your objective conditions in life today in America are very, very, not very much the same as they were in Denmark Vesey's day. But you have to have a working brain to think that. You have to have a connection with your history to know that. But there's this huge program afoot to alienate you from your own self. So that the thing that you ought to understand is important becomes unimportant. And the unimportant becomes important. And that, my friends, is where we are. I can't tell you how profoundly this thing hit me. And you know, I started this series before this event. It was almost a kind of prescient thing. I don't know why I decided that we need to get some things straight here. We're so out of line. We're so out of sync with ourselves. And I'm not just talking about Black folks. This whole society is out of whack. And we keep deluding ourselves by holding on to a reality that simply does not exist. And if it does exist, it is not the same reality for everybody, that's for sure. But it is especially instructive, given recent history, where the nation has its first, quote, Black, unquote, president. All that was invested in this man, not just the money, the votes, the activism, the collective hope of some kind of meaningful change. The expectation, not that paradise is here, but the expectation that our misery index will be lowered. All of this invested in Barack Hussein Obama. And going into the twilight of his term, his two terms. The man just is intentionally oblivious to the constituencies that put him there. And he repeats it and repeats it, and people still will not get the message. And the message that I started talking about is you get the message about systems, how systems work. How are they designed to be lasting, everlasting? You jiggle here, you jiggle there, as might be needed from time to time. But the core of the system remains relatively unchanged over time. That's because it's designed. This is not something that is casual, spontaneous. It's not something that is just kind of, you know, well, it just fell out of the sky like a hailstone. These things are planned. People are running around, you know. Jesse Jackson was crying. A whole bunch of people were crying watching Barack Obama take office. Pride, collective pride, and hope. But according to him, we didn't get grace from Barack Obama. We have not seen the grace from Obama in 8 years, almost 8 years. But you see, for the purposes of the funeral of an assassinated man, the topic we ought to focus on is not the political message here that once again is being sent to African Americans by this white supremacist system. The message we ought to get here is the value of grace. How cynical. And you know, he knew that he was going to get away with that, that minstrel show that he put on there, because he knew that it would drive people crazy, it would drive them wild. He will wipe the floor. He would be a star. But more importantly, as you have seen, it will quickly become a distant memory because nothing that the president said or did that day has any real value in terms of change, in terms of addressing that bridge of history between the days of Denmark Vesey and the days of Clementa Pinckney and 8 others. He has nothing to offer. He has nothing to say. And he has, and clearly, no sense of accountability. He never once said, well, this is what I want to do. I promise you I will do this. No, he says, if you identify with Clementa Pinckney, this is what you ought to do. And what, according to the president, what should we do? It's going to sound so embarrassingly familiar. You should vote. You should vote. Get out there and vote, in parenthesis, for the Democratic Party. You should get out there and vote. Hillary Clinton said the same thing. You should get out there and vote. That's right. Vote for me, of course, in parenthesis. We're not doing anything for you. We're telling you all the things you already know. Do you think that the city of Charleston, South Carolina, had to wait for Barack Obama to come to town to tell them that the schools are rotten? That their healthcare system is rotten? That their unemployment rate is ridiculously high? Inexcusably high? You really think they needed him to come in and deliver an education? But Hillary did the same thing. They all do the same thing. Why? Because that's the system. That's the system they have adopted. That's the system they are part of. It doesn't mean that you have to be part of it. More than anything, it should remind you of the urgency to construct alternative systems that deal with your particular needs and interests. And the number one need and interest that we have at this time is survival. Survival. When all is said and done, that's the main objective of every oppressed group on the planet. They will tell you the first and most important thing is to survive. If you don't survive, you have no future. It's that simple. You can't plan for a future if you don't plan on surviving. We have the evidence. We have the direct experience. We have all the reports and surveys and analyses that you could use. We have all of that. We have the statistics. We have studies of the law. We have all of this available to prove beyond the shadow of any doubt that if you consider yourself a member of an oppressed group in this country, you cannot ignore what all of these things are telling you. And these things have been documented over hundreds of years. If, in the face of all of that, you don't see the need to re-examine what you believe is your reality, if you don't see the need to really make some very important connections here, if you don't see the need to locate yourself both on the horizontal and vertical planes of history, if you don't see the need to understand the systems that govern your life and that have governed the lives of those who came for generations before you, if you choose to ignore all of that, and still defer to the system and still say, I believe things will get better because these people are going to make it better. And all I have to do is show up and cast my vote for these folks. And maybe things will get better. All I have to do is have faith. All I have to do, as the president says, is have grace. By grace, he means inaction. By grace, he means that you become completely pliable. You are a total victim. Do with me whatever you wish, and I will forgive you. Huh? They know what the system is. But look. It's only a couple of days since he was in Charleston. And already, life has gone back to normal. There's no residual effect here. He didn't come in there to be the catalyst for change. He came in there to pacify blacks all over the nation. Don't get mad. Don't go outward. Go inward and find your inner grace. Contemplate and lift yourself on a higher plane. Do all that kind of nonsense. But don't for 1 minute really lock horns with your reality, because now you become dangerous. You become unpredictable. We don't know what you're likely to do. Trust that we can do the right thing. If only, and we have to now defer to the victims to provide guidance here. We can move forward, we, notice the pronoun, we can move forward in this nation if the people who are suffering could just be a little bit more graceful. Summon up some extra grace, serve up some extra grace. And we can get over all of this stuff, this unemployment and rotten schools and unsafe communities and police brutality and unemployment. And we could get around all those things. Those are not really important. What is important is that we have to get along as a society. We've been hearing this garbage for a long time, but now we're hearing it from the president as well. So, when I'm done this week discussing this, I'm going to leave it there for a while and see whether it is going to begin in some small way to get a reassessment going, a national kind of reassessment. And I'll settle even for people, a couple of people on the block. Reconfiguring things with the understanding of where they are with respect to this system and constructing alternatives that have some kind of chance, a very good chance of working, because they can then control these things themselves. And these things being very, very important to the matter of self-determination and true liberation and freedom. You have to control where you live. You have to control your environment. If it is only in your household or as small as your block. But if you keep going with the okey-doke, then you become part of the problem. And you multiply that attitude by millions of people, you see where we are. We are exactly in the same space. And this is not a good space to be. And if it is where you want to be, then why do you think that you should expect a different outcome, a different result? So these are the things that I'm asking you to think about. Don't look to leadership. Leadership has its own marching orders. They're following their system. That's what works for them. And even in his own world, we clearly see Barack Obama does not call the shots. But he's okay with that, because that's the system he decided he wanted to be part of and play ball with. The question again, what is your system? Where is it? Are you constructing one? With what intention? Informed by what? How does this connect to our aggregate survival? That's the only question on the board right now. And don't get sidetracked by these things designed to get you confused. The president is back in the White House and he's doing just fine. His children will go to the right schools and they will, after they leave the White House, they'll do just fine. Your children, what's happening with your kids? What's happening with you? That's the task. And this task falls, of course, to people who believe themselves to be oppressed. I happen to believe I belong in that category. But you will notice that in all of this confusion that's going on, we're not hearing from a whole bunch of people. We're not hearing from them. So it is a dark and lonely job. But because it is important to us, to people who are oppressed in this country, that's your job. And it's the job that your grandfather and grandmother did, and their parents and their parents and their parents did. That's what they did. They've saw to it that they could survive. We have fallen down on the job big time. And we are now doing even worse. We are aiding and abetting a system of annihilation. And we ought to stop it. I want to thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to stretch out and speak my mind. These are tough discussions, but they're also necessary. And I'm not boasting, but I think that they're relevant to our condition, our collective condition today. And it is my hope that it is encouraging, even if it's just 2 or 3 people, it's encouraging a change of attitude by examining our reality and doing something about constructing systems that see to our needs. And that is our number one and perhaps only major purpose right now. We have no other time to do anything else. See to your survival. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can always drop me a note. I do really enjoy hearing from you, and I've been getting great reviews and great exchanges of opinion when you send me an email at leadstories@gmail.com. I'm trying my best to catch up with administrative duties and with my correspondence. But do send me a note. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. A great pleasure and a greater privilege to be in your esteemed company. And I thank you so much for all of your good wishes and your kind thoughts. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.